The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this COVID-19 crisis. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Quick tribute to my producers. The South Africa Radio Awards happened today, and like so many of these events happening, they happen behind closed doors, and there's somebody sitting in front of a camera and presenting and handing out awards, and usually it's a big razzmatazz event, and there are comedians and celebrities, and it's a marvelous radio industry event, and you go there and you have too much wine, and then you lose, and you get very sad, and then you have people having little meltdowns all over the place. It's very entertaining. Very, very entertaining. But today, the first virtual radio awards in 10 years of the radio awards, and The Money Show was named Best Business and Finance Show. Hate that word, finance, but hey, we'll take it. It's on the award. But well done, Cecile. Well done, Dickie. So they get to do the hard work, you see, in the background of The Money Show. And I get to do the fun stuff, which is talking to you. So we're delighted. We're absolutely thrilled that The Money Show has been recognized in this way. So thank you to the very sensible and judges on the SA Radio Awards. We commend you for your sense of style, your sense of taste, and obviously your complete recognition of quality. And we're very grateful that you had enough wine in your lockdown stores to give us that award. It's lovely. Let's talk to Peter Attard-Montalto this evening. He is an economist. He's on the line to us from London tonight. We'll also talk to Director of the Business Rescue Division at Mazars, Justine Hoppy, to try and get an idea of SAA and why government's not yet pulling the plug. Are there options still for SAA? Tato Mashego from Sanlam Private Investments standing by. We'll tell you what's coming up. Make Money Mondays next week. It's huge. And we'll bring you some of the best bits and the best bits of journalism from around the world related to the COVID-19 lockdowns that are keeping about half of the world's population behind closed doors at the moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious.
I'm sure that you were hoping 3 weeks ago that by tonight you would have made your first restaurant booking, you'd be going out to a pub or a club, you'd be letting your hair down post the lockdown. Well, that may have been what you would have thought when the lockdown was announced, and it quickly became apparent that that was never going to happen. And of course, then last week, President Cyril Ramaphosa extended the lockdown by a further 2 weeks. So we enter that phase now. Let's get a perspective from Peter Attard-Montalto, the head of capital markets research at Intelligence. Dex, he's on the line to us from London this evening. I mean, what are the burning issues in this lockdown, Peter? I mean, we're in the life-saving phase. We see South Africa's road deaths over the weekend plummet from 1,600 down to 26 or something over the Easter weekend. Even though nobody's on the roads, we still managed to kill ourselves on our roads. The lockdown, certainly in South Africa, so far proving to be fairly effective, less effective in other countries. The UK has still got very high morbidity rates when it comes to COVID-19. What are the burning issues globally and then locally for South Africa in terms of the mechanisms governments are using to fight the virus?
Good evening, Bruce. Well, congratulations on your award. It's been a fascinating, I think, time to try and look at the evidence of what is actually having an effect. We should remember South Africa locked down very early on, whilst the disease basically was still largely imported and into richer areas in the country. It had some effects, but really the very strong message from the Department of Health this week in that briefing on Monday night was that you can't avoid this becoming a crisis and a very sharp increase in the number of cases and the eventual total number of fatalities in South Africa. And I think that's also been the lesson very much from what's been going on elsewhere around the world, that you are trying to flatten the curve. You're trying to bring things in under the total capacity of your health system. And by doing so, you can save some of those cases. But really, you are moving things around on the chessboard, as opposed to, I think, the view originally when lockdown started of somehow avoiding a large number of cases or a high death rate. I think that's a problem for South Africa, having locked down so early. Remember, the lockdown happened before the first death was announced.
Oh, and maybe that becomes the strategy that is shown to be correct, because by locking down and locking down quickly and aggressively, the economic consequences are devastating. I mean, we saw the Chinese GDP number come through overnight. We're seeing sales numbers from big multinationals are really under a huge amount of pressure. And of course, here in South Africa, we took a very aggressive stance, which could cost our economy 10% growth this year, some forecasts are suggesting. What's your sense of the economic cost versus the strategy of flattening the curve, maintaining health systems, giving the health system the best possible chance it's got to cope in the event of a spike?
Well, this is the fundamental problem. We're trying to offset against each other the economics versus the health. These are not mutually exclusive things, particularly in a country like South Africa, where poverty and the humanitarian crisis, I think, that's growing in South Africa as a result of the lockdown can't be ignored either. And we should remember that a lockdown isn't a simple digital on-off sort of idea. There are many, many shades of grey, as we've seen how it's been put in place around the world. In the UK, I can go out and, I can buy things in the shop. I can buy alcohol in the shop. I can go out and exercise. There are many different forms. And I think the real problem here is that an economic support package was not put in place in large enough size at the start. But also, I think it's now finally dawning on people that the sort of destruction, in particular, of food supply chains within townships, given the rules that were put in place, was complete madness. And is now leading to, I think, an increasing realization there is now going to be a humanitarian crisis going on in parts of South African townships as hunger is setting in. And so, yes, I think we should not just treat a lockdown as sort of a digital on-off. But onto your question on growth, we're at minus 9.7 for this year now, and that's basically based on a view of a very slow recovery, given there's going to be a very large permanent step up in unemployment and also a very large destruction in firms who won't be able to survive this crisis.
Yeah, I mean, the humanitarian crisis that is coming, people are feeling it already. We're seeing lots of people getting very angry. Hungry people become angry very quickly. The question then becomes the funding holes that are created, the crisis that emerges in the economy during and post the lockdowns. I mean, that is fundamental, isn't it? I mean, its consequences, the remedy kills the patient ultimately. And that is something that Donald Trump is hugely cognizant of, and something that the UK government, where you're sitting, is deeply cognizant of as well. It's trying to find this impossible balance between saving lives and saving growth ultimately.
Well, the problem for South Africa, of course, is that in a health crisis, you want to maximize spending and spend as much money as fast as possible, particularly when you add on the need to support those at the bottom end of the pyramid who really are needing those grant top-ups, for instance, that have been discussed, and it's one of the easiest ways of distributing money to that level fastest. You're also in a fiscal crisis where you need to spend the minimum amount possible. And really, I think markets, investors, I think are perplexed why we haven't yet seen an emergency budget, a new fiscal framework coming forward that would add some credibility at the fiscal cliff edge, would allow more spending to occur, more bonds to be issued by being transparent with the markets about what the fiscal shock is that's coming. But this is ultimately where we see a very large funding hole. We see around a 250 billion rand funding hole for the government at this point, which can credibly be dealt with. There are many ideas that could deal with this, including tapping international financial institutions, such as the New Development Bank, even the IMF. There are ways of dealing with this, but we haven't yet seen that joined-up credible package coming forward that can allow us to navigate this joint health and fiscal crisis.
And that's hardly surprising, considering the sort of opposition within the ANC to approaching those global lenders. There's a huge ideological issue within South Africa's government. We don't go to those people because they're the imperialists. Those are the people who want to remove our sovereignty. We're forgetting the position that we're in, or we're not grasping the magnitude of the seriousness of the position that we are in. And I'm imagining that Tito Mboweni is trying to guide his colleagues in cabinet and within the trade union movement, the Tripartite Alliance, through that process.
Well, it's not entirely clear, I think, at the moment, exactly where the first mover, if you like, or the spark on economic policy really is actually coming from. And that's what we're waiting for the cabinet on Monday, really, to provide that guidance. But I think ultimately the issue is a lot of things are unavoidable, and hence we are now seeing South Africa start discussions with the new development bank. They can get $1 billion of health funding from that front, another $3 billion from what's called the CRA facility at the new development bank as well. So there is money available, but you need to move, I think, pretty quickly on this front. But I think there's a more fundamental mindset issue, which is particularly worrying when we think about the speed of recovery from this. We've entered a sort of securocrat mindset around the economy where basically the answer to all questions is no, you can't do that. And that's not how you can ultimately run an economy. I think that's what they've realized in other countries. As the economy opens up, you can't just start saying yes to individual cases. You need a much broader based, risk-adjusted health protocol style of opening up the economy, as opposed to this more securocrat mindset.
We've got big issues of quantitative easing and the sort of remedies that the Reserve Bank can do, and they are buying back bonds and they are cutting interest rates and doing that aggressively, finally. That there's still the problems of Eskom and, of course, SAA and multiple other issues on public sector wages and those sorts of fights that should have been had an awfully long time ago that finally have to be held, and thank goodness they do.
Well, the SARB is in a very interesting position here where it's still trying to maintain this very credible conservative stance, which is fine. But when push really comes to shove, all problems ultimately have to be backstopped by the central bank. And is why I think even though they want to hold out on doing a much larger real QE program in name size, you could call it, say, announcing you to buy, say, 200 billion rand of bonds in a fiscal year, ultimately, they may well be forced into that position because they can move much, much faster, for instance, than, say, trying to get the political cogs to turn on an IMF standby arrangement with conditionality. And that's why I think there's a high probability the SARB will probably ultimately have to do more further down the line. But as you say, those SOE risks are rising. I think markets will, again, talking about expanding fiscal space, if we see SAA finally, the nails in the coffin on SAA, next week at Cabinet, I think that will be positive for markets and for the ability for the government to issue more debt.
Thank you, Peter Attard-Montalte, the head of capital markets research at Intellidex. Well, on SAA, Justine Hoppe is standing by, director of the Business Rescue Division at Mazars for recovery and restructuring. And I mean, I'm surprised the government hasn't used this opportunity to sadly pull the plug on SAA. It's a lovely airline, lovely people, but a millstone around the neck of South Africa. Are there really options left for SAA? Now, the government has made it very clear, Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan, make it very clear that there isn't the 10 billion rand that the business rescue practitioners requested in order to keep the attempted business rescue process happening. Is there a hope? Is there a pulse? Is there a future for this thing?
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to our listeners on, what are we, I think, day one of season two.
too much information.
Sadly,
yes.
I don't think there is much movement left for SAA or the rescue team that were put in place, I think we can all agree, very, very late in the day. Not only has government declined the 10 billion rand funding request, they've declined the ability to fund the care and maintenance, and they've declined the request to seek any further foreign direct investment. There is some pressure that has been brought to bear by the trade unions, as one would expect, because of the fallout we know will flow from any potential liquidation. But I can't see where SAA now goes. Their cargo business, which is still continuing, and the limited amount of activity within the repatriation sphere, given the crisis we find ourselves in, will generate some revenue, but certainly nothing compared to commercial flying.
And that is the problem, is there isn't a business in the air at the moment. And so you would think, well, then you just liquidate it. But the complexity of liquidating SAA with its various debt funding structures and the various liabilities that it's got, plus let's not forget 10,000 people in the broader SAA group who work in the multiple divisions of SAA, this is something that is deeply, deeply complex.
Absolutely. I think that you're 100% right. I think the complexity of it is possibly what has aided SAA in the efforts to save it to this point. I think that what COVID-19 has done is caused a huge focusing on where we find ourselves insofar as SAA is concerned. And I think that government has now found that it can quantify the risk or the exposure it has in the event of liquidation, and they have to balance that against the possibility of sinking another 10 billion rand and possibly more to actually implement any plan going forward. And they now are left trying to decide which one is a more palatable decision. And I think what comes into play when one considers those facts is the optics of where we find ourselves. There's long been a complaint that SAA is a vanity project. I think there were good reasons to explore possible rescue at the outset, although it came very late. Unfortunately, I think what COVID-19 has done is cause us to sit up and look at whether we can afford to be spending 10 billion rand on an airline, as you say, as nice as it may be, when one only has to open the average newspaper and read the standard amount of information that floats around on a daily basis to fully appreciate the complexity and the funding requirements that need to go into our health system. And that's before we even think about the economic impact of the lockdown and the growing, I think, humanitarian crisis that is going to come out of this.
And it should therefore be a fairly simple call, but it simply isn't. I mean, it is a very multifaceted issue. I mean, the business rescue practitioners are, do they have any room at all to wriggle on this thing?
I would imagine that they are having conversations with all the relevant stakeholders, which would be government, the bank lending, trade unions, probably amongst the most important. But absent anyone coming to the party to offer their support, I don't really see where it goes from here. And that's primarily because if they want time to go back to the drawing board, relook at the most probable rescue option that was tabled and palatable to the parties sort of 6 to 8 weeks ago, they need time to do that. And time is money. And they're running an organization that, there's nothing in the air. There is no functioning day-to-day business to really speak of. In order to have the luxury of relooking and reconfigurating that plan, they need someone to fund that. They've got a big overhead structure. They've got a large staff component. The resistance from the unions has been apparent from the outset, which means that even if they wanted to consider a fairly well-used scenario of winding the company down within the business rescue process, they need somebody to actually fund that. And probably the greatest cost component there would be the retrenchment cost, because that remains in full effect while you're in rescue, whereas unfortunately within a liquidation, there's a relatively low capped amount that's paid to employees. So I would imagine the wriggle room, what little there may be, is going to run out fairly fast.
Justine Hoppe, thank you. Director of the Business Rescue Division at Mazars. She's in recovery and restructuring. And SAA, like so many other South African businesses, since the implementation of the legislation that made space for business rescue to happen, you go too late. You simply go too late. And it's like being the person who has chest pains who gets to the hospital on the day after cardiac arrest. There is nothing that the doctors can do. And I think that the business rescue practitioners are finding themselves in that position when it comes to SAA. Let's talk to Tato Mashiho this evening, portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. I am looking at markets and I'm thinking markets are either soothsayers or completely and utterly irrational, considering that we're sitting at, 49,000 and something on the all-share index, hardly 10 or 12% below where we were before this COVID-19 crisis happened or started, Tato. And we're 3 weeks into lockdown and markets are pricing in some kind of recovery at some point in the future. Are they asleep or have they got great foresight?
Good evening, Bruce. And you've raised a very pertinent point. It seems that there's a lot of irrational exuberance at the moment, or perhaps, to be a bit kinder, some wishful thinking in the sense of a V-shaped recovery being priced in at the moment by the market. The data we've been seeing from the real economy over the past few days is obviously telling a very different story to what's currently being priced in. Today, we're up 1.5%, only down about 15% for the year so far, which really does jar against the draconian experience that we've all had globally in the past month. And so, yeah, the market is definitely thinking that this thing will be over, or hoping it will be over fairly soon. We've seen daily fatality rates in southern Europe starting to decline. And so the story goes that the rest of the world will start to wind down the lockdown pretty soon.
Well, I mean, just look at China's GDP number today, and the markets didn't even blink. I mean, overnight we heard that the Chinese economy had shrunk by 6.8% in the first quarter. And that's, I suppose, because it was expected. The second quarter could be worse, considering that economic activity everywhere in the world has been so constrained.
Well, I suppose if you go for surgery and the doctor says you're about to have your leg amputated, you're expecting to have your leg amputated. When you wake up the next day, there really isn't a surprise. And that's sort of the situation we're in at the moment. Very unfortunate, but it is what it is. That's 6.8% year-on-year decline in quarterly Chinese GDP does mask to some extent how bad it really was. Fixed asset investment fell 16%, as well as retail sales also fell by double digits, around 15-16% as well, which then tells you that government spending had to be almost Herculean to get the decline to be only 6.8%. And so how sustainable is that without a gradual recovery? I suppose if you wanted to look at some green shoots, the quarantine in China has is not as bad as it was a few weeks ago. People are starting to move about. So perhaps next month we'll start seeing some positive signs.
Well, certainly not getting any positive signs out of the United States. I mean, the markets there have rallied strongly, despite the fact that we see millions of people every week signing up for unemployment checks, and what, 22 million and growing in the United States.
Mm-hmm. 22 million people lost their jobs in the last 4 weeks.
It's just like we say it, like, oh yeah, 22 million people lost. I mean, just quantify that. That's a third. That's what, that's close to, you know, it's a third of South Africa's entire population lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got that kind of unemployment rate in South Africa, but it's nuts in this massive economy of the US, which was at record low unemployment with record sort of growth, unbroken growth for more than a decade. And in a month, it all goes pear-shaped.
It is. A month ago, they were sitting at 3% unemployment, and now at around 13% unemployment. It really does beg a belief. If you think of the Great Depression, unemployment reached 25% in the U.S., and we're already at around 13%. We're likely to see further job losses in the next few weeks, so who knows how far that number will go. But it's... This really is an unprecedented black swan which we've been faced with.
Are we waiting for you to use the word unprecedented? I'm trying not to use the word because it's been used so much, because it's unprecedented. We're using it an unprecedented number of times. Zieder and Implats, I mean, companies are coming out with real company news. It's weird, but they are. What are you getting out of those announcements?
Well, Zieder did release a SENS this morning, just giving an update on their financial performance for the year that's just recently ended. So HEPS were up 18%, which is a very credible, strong performance. Although, of course, obviously the year ended end of Feb, so that doesn't include perhaps the worst of the recent lockdown. Although most of their subsidiaries are essential services, they do continue operating. The big news there also, of course, the Pioneer acquisition. So they've disposed of their investment in Pioneer Foods to PepsiCo, which brought in a hefty chunk of cash, about $5 billion. Which they used to pay off all of their debt and a special dividend, and still have about $4 billion left in cash sitting on the balance sheet. So even in a disaster such as the one we're currently experiencing, there's always winners and losers. Yeah. And I suppose agro-processing being one of the short-term winners.
Tato, thank you very much. Tato Mashiko is Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth on the line to us on The Money Show this evening. I was telling you earlier about this week about Captain Tom Moore, the 99-year-old who decided he was going to walk before his 100th birthday 100 laps of the garden in the care home that he is. And he's recently had a big hip operation, and he's pushing his little walker along. And it's an arduous slog for a man of 99 who's just had major surgery. Well, it's created a phenomenon in the UK, which is in versions of lockdown, as Peter Attard-Montalto was telling us, except they can go for walks and they can buy booze. Talk about FOMO. But Captain Tom Weir, now, you plan to raise £1,000 for the National Health Service. You went walkabout, and with some publicity and with people just falling in love with this old guy, he's raised £19 million. And now he and Michael Ball, if you don't know Michael Ball, he's one of these West End stars of Andrew Lloyd Webber's musicals. So this Captain Tom Weir and Michael Ball have recorded a charity single of You'll Never Walk Alone, which, of course, is the Liverpool Football Club song. And this guy, Tom Weir, is doing great national duty. £19 million. I mean, in real money, that's like 350 million rand. It's a most astonishing, astonishing achievement.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this crisis. That's African nacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Well, coming up on your next Money Show, I'll have the singer, entrepreneur, designer Nathaniel on for Make Money Mondays. We've been asking him for years, and finally, he's got a gap, hasn't he, like everybody else. But it's so good to get Nathaniel onto the show. He's a magnificent, magnificent performer, and I'm looking forward to learning a lot more about him. Also, business book feature, Alan Knott Craig, joining me on his latest co-authored book, Connected, A Brief History of Global Telecommunications. That's all coming up next time on The Money Show.
702. Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, we're telling you lots of scary stories at the moment. We're telling you some uplifting stories. We're trying to balance the Money Show with as many tales as we can of people making a plan, people helping out, people doing incredible things. Lots of really good stuff happening in the world at a time of deep uncertainty and crisis as well. So time for your best bits tonight. And Martin Kingston, who is the Vice President of BUSA, Business Unity South Africa, he is the leader of the Economic Intervention Workgroup for Business for South Africa. Now, Business for South Africa is not a new organization, because there are lots of business organizations, but it's the vehicle they're using as an amalgamated view of business organizations. So Black Business Council and others, everybody coming together under one initiative to work with government on the crisis that we face. And we're talking about the extended lockdown on the business sector, and saying that, yeah, but here's Martin Kingston saying he agrees with the Reserve Bank Governor and the Finance Minister that we do need some real fresh thinking of the crisis.
Well, there is no doubt whatsoever that we're going to have to take very difficult decisions as a country, and this may well be the opportunity to grasp the metal where previously it was difficult so to do. We're going to have to make extraordinarily tough choices about our priorities, and to the extent that, for example, state-owned enterprises aren't critically, systemically important, then they're going to have to be put to one side whilst we allocate priority funding elsewhere. There's going to be a need for significant fiscal stimulus. It's going to come with conditions and strings attached from wherever it comes, whether it's domestically or internationally. We're going to have to cut through much of the undergrowth that was constraining economic growth in the past, recognizing that we now are in a very different set of circumstances against the backdrop not only of a recession, which we're already in, but compounded by the downgrade and, of course, magnified by COVID-19. Our own view is that we're not going to be in a recession. We're going to be in a depression, and it's going to take very significant action to be able to ensure that we can achieve the sort of economic growth that we require when we come out of it.
And, I mean, everybody's on the same page here, that we need significant steps, but the political choices that have to be made are a big trade-off for government, and one gets that. But at the same time, the country, you drag the country through great difficulty over longer periods of time. Short, sharp shocks sometimes can be very helpful. We certainly need a very big stimulus package. And Nazmira Moola, the head of investments at 91, was explaining this week how the SMME sector employs at least 47% of the workforce at the moment. And really, this is the area that can drag us out of the morass.
The number that we are going to need in terms of a COVID-19 stimulus plan, I think, should be at least 100 billion rand. If we look at the money that's being spent in other countries, developed markets are throwing somewhere between 12 and 15% of GDP as a problem. Emerging markets Brazil, 3.5%, Malaysia, Indonesia, similar sort of quantum. So South Africa, I would expect we need at least 100 billion rands at this point in time in order to keep our economy functional enough, in order to sustain jobs in the longer term and sustain the tax base once this crisis is finished.
Now, if this was up to Busisiwe Mkhwebane, she'd be finding a printing press somewhere and firing it up with cheap diesel in order to print more money. That is not the solution.
No, that's not the solution, because ultimately that will result in other problems. And in that way lies Venezuela and Zimbabwe. So printing press in a emerging market is not the solution, unfortunately, much as we would like it to be.
So what is the solution? This money has got to come from somewhere. Yes, we've got to support. Yes, we've got to back people up. Yes, we've got to try and keep wages going. Yes, all of these things. But the money's got to come from somewhere. And there are not too many places it can be taken from. Or what have I missed?
Well, I think ultimately, in the medium term, it needs to come out of the South African bond market. So you need to create an environment where governments can issue the bonds into the local market. But in the short term, we're going to have to find some sort of bridge financing. We're already talking about $1 billion from the New Development Bank, aka the BRICS Bank. We should explore whether there's more from there, or whether we look at bilateral loans, perhaps from the Chinese. Or ultimately, I think the ANC may need to make peace with talking to the likes of the IMF. I know they have a great number of countries talking to them at this point in time, but I think that the conditionality that the IMF applies these days is, especially in situations like this, will be far more friendly than the old structural adjustment program, and that has to be something that we consider.
Well, there was another big story this week, and this was the battle between Discovery and Liberty. Discovery's rival, Liberty, has been using for the last year or so the Vitality program created and developed by Discovery using their members' data. Liberty struck on a big idea, saying, well, if Discovery does all the work and somebody has a status, a Vitality status, why don't we use it to mitigate our risk and offer benefits to our own members using Discovery's program? It seemed like a bright idea at the time. Discovery got cross, it all went to court, and this week David Munro, who's the Liberty chief executive, explained why his company was prepared to go to court and win.
To use the what we say to customers is, if you're a member of an external wellness program, Vitality is just is one of those programs that we recognize. Share your status with us and we'll give you a cashback benefit reflecting your efforts towards leading a healthy lifestyle. And we use the tiering provided by the wellness program to assess or to act as a risk proxy for us, and that's how the program works.
You weren't only using Discovery's program, you were also using MMI's program as well, and that's Momentum's program. I don't think they've taken court action, but I mean, one would assume that the same T's and C's would apply to their initial objections in this particular matter as well.
Yeah, Bruce, that would be up to MMI to respond to that. We're offering what we think is a valuable benefit to customers to use what is their property, which is a status that belongs to them as a result of being part of these programs. That's, I think, the question that's at stake here. What does it reflect? It reflects the fact that ecosystems or the value that gets created in one ecosystem can be used in another ecosystem. And in many respects, this represents the demonstration that open ecosystems can be very powerful for customers. You can choose your wellness program in one supplier and your life insurance from another supplier, and that gives real ultimate choice to the consumer. That's what we were after demonstrating, and we don't think we acted unethically or illegally, and that's been borne out by the judgment.
David Munro, Chief Executive of Liberty, a fascinating battle which has played out in South African courts. And we spoke to Hilton Kalner as well this week. He's the Chief Executive of Discovery South Africa. And he was saying they'll abide by it. They don't like it. That's not for a moment do they like it, but it's, the courts have ruled and they will stick to that ruling. The battle between Liberty and Discovery decided in favor, of course, of Discovery. And this thing goes back 30 years, because who used to work at Liberty when he was in his 20s as an actuary? Oh, yes, one Adrian Gore. So the two, you know, there's an immense amount of rivalry between the two companies.
The show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this crisis. That's African Nacity. APSA's a registered FSP.
I'm really loving reading stories from around the world all about COVID-19. The topic is depressing as hell, but we're learning so much about pandemics, about the illness, about humanity's response to this illness, which is, I think, what is so absolutely uplifting and inspiring. Even people in the most awful of circumstances, the doctors that have to deal with this stuff. I was listening to a podcast yesterday of 24 hours in a Brooklyn emergency room and a really characterful, colorful doctor speaking to the reporters, and just the process they go through in these emergency rooms to help deal with patients. And they're dealing with humanity, and these are deeply compassionate people who don't necessarily show compassion in the way that a charity worker might, but they are being businesslike and compassionate and professional and saving lives, and it's amazing. Anyway, this piece from Vogue magazine, because we're very diverse, we read all kinds of things. It's not the 19th century, it just feels like it. It's been 102 years since the last major pandemic swept America, which was the rest of the world too, Vogue. The 1918 flu pandemic, known also as the Spanish flu because Spain was the only country to accurately report it, a lot has changed in 102 years, but it took at social media, but a look at social media, which they didn't have 102 years ago, might suggest that some people are getting through their coronavirus lockdown in much the same way as people got through it during the Spanish flu. Yes, we may have the internet now, but we also have copious amounts of old-timey activities which are being re-embraced. Suddenly, everyone's doing many of the things people did in 1918, returning to the traditions and activities that might have occupied their parents or grandparents in the waning days of the previous century. It may not be the 1890s, but at times, it certainly feels like it. This may have all started naturally as a return to a previous lifetime can start. Americans on the front line need personal protective gear. Doctors and nurses made desperate, tearful appeals on television, so people got working making masks. First for medical professionals, who probably would have preferred N95 masks, but then later for ourselves, as New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio employed New Yorkers to make their own masks to avoid buying up the precious supplies of medical ones. Suddenly everybody was making masks. The internet was filled with pictures of handmade masks, with thousands of people turning to Twitter, Pinterest and Instagram Live with sewing tutorials. I was intrigued, but not intrigued enough to do it. And then there was the baking, which in itself started out somewhat as a necessity. After all, a fresh direct delivery spot was vanishingly rare and almost impossible to get. Instacart and a trip to the market feels like a game of Russian roulette. But there's baking, and then there's baking. If only I had a dollar for everything the internet discourse that I've seen of creating bread. Yesterday, the phrase sourdough starter was trending on Twitter. You know, sourdough starter, a mixture that's kept in the fridge for months and then trotted out and used to leaven the dough for our bread. The hashtag lockdown baking produces hundreds of results. Comfort baking has been observed in Italy. In the United States, there's been an unprecedented demand situation for flour and other home baking ingredients. But even as other activities we are doing in this quarantine have a distinct whiff of nostalgia and a longing for the past, their families gathering around old-fashioned puzzles and board games and renewed obsession for gardening and flowers. Just lovely sort of perspective on what is maybe really important in life and what you lose in the busyness of being busy in life. And then one of my favorite people on the planet is an actor called James Corden, who's done very successfully Trevor Noah style in the United States. And he presents The Late Late Show. You may know him as the guy from Carpool Karaoke as well. But he talks about The Late Late Show and the stuff they've gone through in that production of that show. And on Wednesday evening, he says, we taped our last show in studio. Our executive producer came out and took a photo of the packed crowd. I think it's going to be a long time before there's an audience in here again, he said. I've never seen the news change as rapidly as it did the other day. Border closures, shutdowns, terrifying statistics. By the time I came home to my wife and children that night, it felt like an entirely different world. At first, we thought how to do our show without an audience, but then within hours it became clear that the entire staff of The Late Late Show couldn't even be in the same room anymore. I know how important arts and entertainment are. I say this as somebody who's watched As Good As It Gets three nights in a row. What a masterpiece of a movie that is. We need those comforts most of all when people are sad and scared and anxious, as we all are. So we wanted to do something that would bring people of all generations together while keeping them safely apart. And that's how we first conceived of Homefest, a special featuring guests of performers broadcasting from their own homes. And when it aired on March the 30th, it was truly global. I was in my home, going to the homes of performers around the world, from Andrea Bocelli in Italy to BTS in Korea and Dua Lipa in Britain. We talked a lot about what comedy we wanted to write for the show. Ultimately, we came to the conclusion that the best thing was to be authentic, to simply say, this is how I'm feeling. This is all right to feel that way. With everything in hiatus, it can feel like there are no days anymore. You're just awake and you're asleep. A good friend of mine lost their husband recently on the same day that another close friend came off their ventilator and got to go home. I felt unbelievably far away from my family and friends in the UK, but there's nowhere else to go, so you might as well settle in and know whatever it is that you're feeling, it's just a guest who's popping around, and that too will pass. Has this moment in time made people yearn for collective experiences? So much of what we do and consume is solitary, watching things on our phones. You come into work and say, oh, don't tell me, I'm only on episode 5. But for the first time with this, we're really in something together. I'm actually thinking of calling it social distancing as a mistake. It's a term that couldn't be more wrong. We're physically distancing. Socially, I don't know if I've ever felt so connected to my family and friends. I've been calling people I haven't spoken to in years because they just pop into my head and I think, I'm going to check in and see how they're doing. And I can see now that I've taken so many things for granted, things for which I'm now acutely grateful. When things do revert to some kind of normalcy, whatever that is, I hope I don't forget this feeling. I've never felt less inspired or creative, but the show must go on. That's true of what we create, but it's also true of how we care for those closest to us. What matters is how we look after the people we love and to be there for them. And when all else fails, the power of a good deep breath, a chuckle with a friend, and a glass of wine should never be underestimated. What a serious guy James Corden can be. What a lovely guy James Corden is. I just love his relationship with Tom Cruise. It is the weirdest thing. And his relationship with David Beckham, this chubby comedian who is as funny as anything, is besties with these guys who clearly find him deeply amusing and deeply deeply trustworthy as a mate and bring him into their lives. It's just lovely. That's it for The Money Show for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Please do tune in again next week. I'm